Good morning and welcome to the July 15th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my guest host, Kevin Kennedy. Kevin, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Roger.
We've got a pretty interesting show coming up. First, we're going to start with Professor Melissa Jacoby. She's going to discuss her new book, Unjust Debts, which explores the inequalities in the American bankruptcy system.
Then Heather Ledbetter will join us in studio to discuss the new retail outlet operated by the Christian Center, Summit Exchange. We'll finish our hour by chatting with Matt Hopkins of Cortona Italian Cafe, which is now open for lunch.
All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Bankruptcy in this country is big business. Indeed, the U.S. bankruptcy courts are the busiest federal courts in America. And while bankruptcies of major companies, think Purdue Pharma, and nonprofit organization like the Boy Scouts or certain dioceses of the Catholic Church, while those bankruptcies get a lot of media attention, the vast number of personal bankruptcies do not. And in her new book, Professor Melissa Jacoby highlights the differences between the way real people and what she labels as fake people are treated. We are very lucky to be joined by a real person, Professor Melissa Jacoby, this morning. Good morning, Professor Jacoby.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Professor Jacoby, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, I wrote the book because bankruptcy affects everyone, and not just their wallets. So with respect to personal bankruptcy, households that file, my colleague Bob Lawless estimates that 1 out of 10 every living American has been through bankruptcy at least once. We may not know that our neighbors have had to use bankruptcy. It's not something they want to share with us, but it really is all around us. And we should have more awareness of this. When we look at the bigger cases, they're affecting everyone and in a different way. We're talking about gun violence, race inequality, police misconduct, and even climate change are all affected by bankruptcy. Even the ability of states to write and enforce their own laws and the liberties of individuals are also affected. So wherever one stands on the political spectrum, they should be interested in this topic. Now, you asked how long it took to write this book. I would say technically I started writing it in 2020, but there's a difference between writing the book and everything that comes into thinking about it and the research, which I would throw way back to the beginning of my career. The book actually starts with me deciding whether I'm going to even take the class of bankruptcy law in law school or not. And if I hadn't, we probably would not be having this conversation.
Nice. Hey, can you share a bit about the history of bankruptcy in this country and how the basic building blocks of the system were put together?
Bankruptcy has been in the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, since the very beginning. So it is not some newfangled idea in America or in longer history, although it has meant different things at different times. But there's always been the problem of someone having multiple creditors and not being able to pay back a group of people, not just one. It's not just debtor versus creditor, it's creditor versus creditor. And we need to have some collective mechanism. So Congress has been authorized to write bankruptcy laws for a really long time, but it didn't really do so on a consistent basis until 1898. And the system we have now has been in place more or less since 1978, although it has changed a lot since then.
And one of the things you mentioned that I do want to touch back on, one of the fun things about this book is there are parallel stories here. There's a story about how the bankruptcy system worked, and then there's your own story, starting with how you took the class and how you worked on various commissions. You were really highly influenced by that first class, weren't you?
I was. It takes a good teacher who's teaching pretty much anything to get you inspired to continue to study and be involved with something. And I was really optimistic about the role of the bankruptcy system. And I've fallen a little out of love, although I think the system is still very, very important in our economy and society. This is not a call to abandon it by any means, but to rethink what role it should be playing here.
One of the big things in your framework is the distinction between what we talked about, real people and fake people. Let's talk about real people first. What are the basic types of personal bankruptcy, and what is the profile of the typical filer?
Personal bankruptcy in America has a dual personality in a couple ways, because on the one hand, it is seen throughout the world as American bankruptcy law being really protective of the household relative to what other systems used to do. But over time, it is less protective and more expensive, both because the consumer credit industry has strongly advocated to make bankruptcy less accessible, but also because America, on a bipartisan basis, prefer some time to make families think it's their own fault that they're in financial trouble and is distrustful of family financial distress. What we end up having then is two different types of personal bankruptcy, one that moves faster and gives more debt cancellation with more certainty, and then a longer process that requires a repayment plan, which sounds reasonable until we look at the history of how it's worked. And over time, we see that families have so much trouble finishing these plans, they don't cancel their debts. They pay a lot of money into the system, they pay a lot of money to lawyers, and they don't get relief. And this two-tiered system is a big part of what makes bankruptcy racially discriminatory, that there are big racial disparities in our personal bankruptcy system today.
Now, if I was going to declare bankruptcy, would Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 be better for just the average individual?
Well, if I'm playing a lawyer here in practice, I would have to ask you a lot more questions. And there are some benefits of this Chapter 13, the longer path and repayment plan, that are advantageous for some people. They are, for example, if someone has a mortgage in default, they've missed some payments, but they really can get back on track and their mortgage lender won't work with them. Chapter 13 gives you a path to fix your mortgage. You can't change any terms other than catching up. So you have to basically double pay for a while. And of course, that's pretty hard for some people. So there are benefits of that nature. People also use it to catch up on their car payments. The problem is that so many of the people who use Chapter 13 don't have those particular problems to solve and don't have a stable enough income to make it all the way through the end. So those are some of the things I'd want to know from you if you were considering bankruptcy. But oftentimes, because of the economics of law practice when dealing with low-income consumers, sometimes the answer is already decided before they've gone into the door, depending on which lawyer they happen to pick.
So let's talk a little. One of the things that was really interesting in the book to me was, and you sort of made reference to this, there's a sort of moral overhang over all this, that the laws sort of suggest that individuals who have declared bankruptcy are somehow morally inadequate. It's not stated, but I sort of felt like it was there. What kind of debts are not being discharged in personal bankruptcies?
Well, some of the debts that can't be canceled in personal bankruptcy are categories that I agree with. I think it's important that if someone has willfully and maliciously injured another person, those aren't the kinds of obligation that a bankruptcy system was meant to forgive. This is a system meant for more commercial debts, whether you're an individual or a corporation, debts that when you've borrowed money, that's the basic tenor of it. Now, so when we see parts of the list are about bad behavior, willful and malicious injury, if someone commits fraud. Now, these are not typical obligations of the average American household, but they are important reminders that bankruptcy is not for that kind of bad behavior, unless you're a big corporation.
Which
then
we'll
it's
get
a whole
to.
Other story. There are other things on the do not discharge list or can't be canceled list that I think warrant more attention. Student loans used to be a category that if you paid for several years and then got yourself in real financial trouble, there was a path to cancellation of student loans. The government has chipped away at that over time to the extent that now it used to be about protecting the public fisc, that the argument was, well, we need to cut back on this so there's more money to guarantee other student loans. The problem is now the prohibition on cancellation is so broad that it even covers completely private student loans, including for for-profit schools where people do not get degrees and they can't finish when the school closes. A lot of those kind of stories of people in a lot of different kinds of educational experiences that aren't able to finish. And so that's a concern. Also, fees and fines that local governments impose largely on communities of color for not mowing your lawn or a parking ticket or that sort of thing, those have ended up being protected from being canceled, not because of what Congress said, but because the Supreme Court interpreted that exception really broadly. And what the Supreme Court says goes. So there we are.
Well, now, what are the economic challenges of filing, and how often do lower income filers actually end up with some kind of effective relief?
Well, the barriers to filing are, of course, some of them are non-economic. They are acknowledging that this problem cannot be solved in other ways. The research shows that people try everything they can before they go to bankruptcy, that it's not their first choice by any means. Once that realization hits, things are pretty dire. The system has become so complicated that you really need a lawyer. Some people try to file without a lawyer. Those cases don't go as well. The system has just become too much of a labyrinth. Lawyers, while way cheaper for personal bankruptcy than those big business bankruptcies, are a lot of money when we're talking about real people. So the quicker case might be, there, it can vary. Maybe we'll say between $1,000 and $2,000. There's also Congress imposed a credit counseling requirement, even if you're in bankruptcy because you got sick and then you lost your job. Credit counseling isn't going to help you, but you have to pay for that. You have to pay for a financial education course on the way out. But if you're in that more straightforward Chapter 7, chances are you're going to get a lot of debts canceled. Not everything, but a lot. In Chapter 13, that payment plan chapter, there it's more expensive to file because it's longer. There are more moving pieces. A plan has to be written. The trick is that lawyers will, in that case, you can pay your lawyers through that payment plan. You don't need to pay the lawyer up front like you do in Chapter 7. And by the way, that Chapter 7 issue is not the lawyer's fault. It's what Congress said and what the Supreme Court said, that you had to pay your lawyer beforehand or else it was going to be a debt that would be canceled like everything else. So that's what's leading people who don't have the cash, some of the worst off, to end up in a repayment plan where they have to commit all their income for 3 to 5 years to have any shot at debt cancellation. And historically, 2/3 of the people who file do not finish. The rate is way lower for African-American families who are already overrepresented in bankruptcy because of credit and income and other discrimination in our general society. But then bankruptcy piles on by steering them to Chapter 13, and they have a higher rate of non-completion, those families do.
So let's do the segue from real people to fake people. What ways do fake people, corporations, not-for-profits, how do they get more of a fresh start than real people?
They get more of a fresh start than real people because Congress said so, first of all, and then, and I'll tell you why in a minute, and
I can
then
guess why.
But then also because the system is more deferential to the lawyers at the fancy suits and the fancy clients than it is to more average people. So let's start with what Congress did. So I use the term fake people because, sure, we're talking about for-profit corporations and especially the big ones. We are also talking about nonprofits and cities and other entities that form using business associations, but we don't think of them as corporations. So It's just easier to call them fake people. Some people think that's a little bit pejorative, but I'm just trying to get to the point that they're not, they don't bleed and they don't die in a normal way. So what are the differences? So fake people can cancel a lot more debt and types of debt than real people, including debts for willful and malicious injury, which is a very big distinction. I'm not saying that individuals should be able to cancel those debts, but it is shocking to me that businesses can. There are lots of arguments given for that that I can answer questions about, but that's the system we have. Fake people also get debt cancellation much faster in this Chapter 11, the reorganization chapter for companies and others, than real people in that repayment plan that we were just talking about, that Chapter 13. Chapter 13, you have to make it all the way to the end to get debt cancellation. For corporations in Chapter 11, they get debt cancellation right as soon as their plan is confirmed and put into effect, once the judge puts the stamp of approval on. Now, you might think, well, that's because the fake people always complete their plan. They're a sure thing. Nope, that is not how it works. Both in fake people and real people do not have strong track records in completing the plan. And there are a lot of legitimate reasons for that. The difference is who bears the risk. So we have one-way finality in Chapter 11. For corporations and other fake people, we also see a lot more flexibility in the system generally about going off to trying different paths to using the bankruptcy power, which is an extraordinary national power to use without all the checks and balances. Real people aren't given that kind of flexibility. Real people have more oversight. And again, sort of that morality overlooking. What exactly are you spending your money on? Mm. What do you mean you had a streaming service for your children to watch if you're in bankruptcy? We can talk about those kinds of questions. We don't see that, especially with the very largest companies. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the municipalities, and how have the effects of bankruptcy in municipalities morphed over time to the detriment of civil rights victims?
This is the extraordinary thing, or a really good example of why so many more people should be thinking about this topic than currently are, because right now, bankruptcy is undercutting the quest for more accountability in areas like police violence and misconduct and other kinds of civil rights problems. And this was not an intentional design feature of bankruptcy, but it happened because early in the history of municipal bankruptcy, which started in the 1930s, it was used only for municipal bonds. So one of the superpowers that bankruptcy has in a reorganization is to say, well, if I can get many of my creditors can agree, I can force everyone else to accept the results. And that can be very important when you're dealing with a group of bondholders, other financial creditors who are in it for investment, and many of them see that it's kind of in their best interest to restructure, literally restructure the terms. Different interest rate, different payment terms, maybe it's a couple years longer, whatever it is. But there could be a couple holdouts that say, no, no, I want the whole thing. And then everybody may lose. So bankruptcy does have an important effect there, and it was applied to municipal bonds. Okay. Well, by the time we get to the 70s, there is a push for more expansive municipal bankruptcy to look more like what we'd have in a Chapter 11. We can blame New York City, or really the federal government's unwillingness to bail out New York City for this, even though they never actually used bankruptcy. So bankruptcy for municipalities, and especially big cities, became much more broad and flexible and gave a lot more power to a city to make changes to a lot of different kinds of obligations, including civil rights or other torts. Someone might be hit by a bus, and now they're a creditor in a bankruptcy too. And so what we're seeing in the very rare cases for now, because it isn't easy to put a city into bankruptcy to begin with, But the cities who do go into bankruptcy do tend to have a higher rate of police misconduct alleged. They may be majority black or brown cities and the like. And so we're seeing no seat at the negotiating table for those claimants, and they're getting really the lowest payout of anyone.
I want to touch on, we don't have much time left, so let's go right to how the bankruptcy system has evolved to become a vehicle for liability management.
Well, many listeners may have heard about the Purdue Pharma case that went to the Supreme Court recently, and that is an example of decades of companies who have been accused of cover-ups of harm and products or activities that have hurt lots of people. And they've used bankruptcy like a legal Swiss Army knife to say the system was meant for companies that were in financial trouble in more traditional ways. They couldn't pay back their loans. They have bonds that they need to rewrite the terms of. These cases say, well, these lawsuits are threatening us, and we think we want to use bankruptcy for its very powerful pieces, that, like we've talked about, that it can change everybody's rights forever. And it's really hard to do that in other parts of the legal system. And so they've been pushing the envelope on this for many years. Some of it is well-intentioned, and some has gone way too far and maybe making us less safe as a result if there isn't proper accountability there as well. So I think bankruptcy really would need to be redesigned to balance all of those concerns. It's not up to the job in its current form.
So let's take it down one level. Just sort of explain how this works, whether it's the Robbins case or Jantz Manville or Purdue. What are they doing? We've got, you know, a class of people who, some of whom may have not made a claim yet. They may not even know they're sick. So how do they sort of stuff that liability into an entity and declare bankruptcy and protect the rest of the business? It seems like a pretty slick trick.
It's a wild thing to do in our legal system. We do have constitutional protections like due process. And the way it works, and you've put your finger on exactly the issue of there's a group of claimants who know they're hurt today. And then there are people who may not get hurt or realize that this product has injured them until decades from now. And these cases purport to change the rights of both. They do put in place a representative to represent the rights of those future claimants. The Supreme Court's never ruled on whether that's adequate, so maybe that's the next thing that's coming. But the definition of claim is really broad in bankruptcy. It includes people that don't have traditional loans, but that have a lot of different types of injuries. It also doesn't depend on other legal definitions of when you have a legal claim. So people who may get hurt later but were exposed before the bankruptcy, some courts say that counts. They can be treated in bankruptcy.
I do want to touch on one more thing. We had a Supreme Court decision in Purdue Pharma, and one of the things that got the most attention was the way that the bankruptcy in Purdue reached out to release non-bankrupt entities, specifically the Sackler family, which is, you know, a pretty broad thing to do. Tell us about what the Supreme Court said, and where do you think that leads us?
This has been a question the Supreme Court should have answered decades ago, and it would have saved a lot of hardship that's coming up in the Purdue Pharma case and elsewhere. The bankruptcy code does not say that it protects third parties from their own wrongdoing unless a claimant consents. We're always allowed to do a settlement. I can decide to release anyone I'd like in a contract. The issue is whether the Sacklers could be protected from people who did not agree, and that could be done in the context of the bankruptcy of a company, Purdue Pharma. On a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said, no, you cannot terminate someone's rights against the Sacklers without those claimants' consent. So the next battle will be, what is consent? And there are a couple other little twists and turns. Lawyers are very creative, so this is not the end of mass tort bankruptcy, but it will make it harder, including for companies like Johnson & Johnson and others who are trying to use the bankruptcy of one entity to protect a lot of other companies that might be very profitable, very different from what the framers thought about when they're first putting bankruptcy in the Constitution.
Wow, it sounds very, very, quite a cluster. Now, what can be done to the system to change it to promote more fairness to fake people and people?
I think the first thing to realize is that the dynamics we're seeing in the bankruptcy system really are a microcosm of the issues we're encountering more generally. These are hierarchies and biases that we have throughout the legal system. So there's definitely things we can do in the bankruptcy system, but that will never resolve all of it. But there are big picture questions we can ask about the bankruptcy system, like, should it be for all these kinds of claims? Should we narrow it? Should we make consumer bankruptcy or personal bankruptcy way simpler? I think the answer to that question is certainly yes. And then there are more technical questions that I go through at the end of Unjust Debts that by the time people read it, they hopefully will know what I'm talking about, rather than this just being an issue for specialists. But I think that's the one thing I'd want to end with, to say these areas become very specialized, and that becomes a barrier to the people who are affected by the system really understanding what's going on. And so what Unjust Debts is trying to do is encourage more people to ask more questions about from their elected officials, if they are involved in a case or in any other context that they can, because we need more transparency here for people to understand how their rights are being affected.
The book is Unjust Debts. We've been lucky to talk to Melissa Jacoby. For a book about bankruptcy, it is surprisingly readable. Professor Jacoby, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for including me.
We'll be right back after this.
Summit Exchange is the latest retail outlet operated by the Christian Center of Park City. Here to tell us about it is the manager, Heather Ledbetter.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
So, just a little bit about our store. Christian Center of Park City has been around for more than 20 years, and we just have a wide array of services that we offer our community. And a fun fact for you, CCPC receives 1.7 million pounds of donated clothes, shoes, and textiles every single year. And then we then sort it, upcycle 780,000 of those pounds, and then we resell it. We have a kind of a new little model, recycle, reimagine, and relove. Reusing just one item of clothes and textile every year will reduce that item's carbon footprint by 82%.
Outstanding. Now, when did the Summit Exchange open, and where exactly is it?
Okay, we opened on July 8th, and we have just been going strong ever since, so just a little over a week. We're open Monday through Saturday. We are at the outlets of Park City, directly right beside Pearl Izumi and Nike.
Oh, up there, yeah.
So you said that's it. So I was interested in that percentage of, like, what is it, 700,000 of the 1.2 million pounds?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what happens to the rest?
Well, sometimes people don't donate their best items. So therefore, some of it gets tossed, as mm-hmm. it should. Others that are not sellable and usable within our community, we then turn around and sell as well.
Mm-hmm. So it's complicated. How do you, I mean, that process, I'm visualizing an assembly line. I mean, and, you know, I've driven up to the Christian Center and dropped off clothing. How does that process work? The sorting and the categorizing.
Awesome. We have a great receiving team. We have donations that we receive all 6 days a week that we're open. Donations in Park City from 9 to 3. It's Saturday 10 to 2. In Heber Valley, we're open 10 to 2 Wednesday and Friday. And we have an awesome team that just takes the stuff. We sort it, we price it at what we think is a fair rate, and then we put it out into our stores. And we opened this store because of the sheer volume. We just, our three little stores couldn't handle it, and so we had to go ahead and open a larger space. It's beautiful, it's 7,000 square feet.
Gotcha, and what is the difference between Summit Exchange and the other outlets?
It's big. It's very big. We have a lot. Most of our rec gear is there. It's all new and very gently used clothing, furniture, home goods, rec gear, and there's a lot of different cool little treasures. You might find some vintage finds, some cool vinyl, some records, some really awesome art. I mean, it's just the thrill of the hunt, so.
Now, you anticipated my next question, which is what kinds of merchandise do you stock? So it's not just clothing.
No. Okay. We have, like I said, clothing, furniture, shoes, rec gear. At the Summit Exchange location, we have the majority of the rec gear for our stores. And come wintertime, you know what that looks like. It's just mostly skis and snowboards and stuff. So, I mean, you can find amazing, very gently used and sometimes even new stuff for just a fraction of the price that you would pay in retail.
So could somebody move from, let's say, Hawaii, come here for the winter, and get everything they need, clothes, furniture, kitchenware, all at Summit Exchange?
Most definitely, and they would save tons of money.
Nice.
So let's talk about pricing. How do you determine the pricing, and what kind of price range would I see for clothing?
Well, it just very much depends. I can tell you right now that at Summit Exchange, you can find an item for $2 and you can find an item for $100. So, I mean, it really just depends. Most of our stuff is very attainable for our community because that's what we're here to do, is to serve. And so I would say when we were pricing our items at the new store, I mean, I was looking at the tags and we were putting out a lot of $15 items. So, I mean, there's just runs the gamut. We have everything from a more generic brand all the way up to, I sold Prada shoes yesterday or last week.
Do you remember how much they went for?
About $100.
Well, whoa. The devil can afford it.
Yeah. I'm sending my daughter over. She loves thrifting.
Please
she
do.
She will love it.
Yeah, it's great.
Now, how do people donate items to be sold at the exchange? Just over at the Christian Center, or is there a collection at the exchange?
Unfortunately, we don't have the ability to take donations at Summit Exchange just because of the location. So all of our donations need to come through 1283 Deer Valley Drive, Monday through Saturday, 9 to 3 in Park City, and 10 to 2 on Saturday. And then again, we have a store in Heber, and those donations can be dropped off from 10 to 2 on Wednesday and Friday. Additionally, we have the option where you can email us if you need a pickup, and a team will get in touch with you and decide when we could come and pick up your stuff.
So we've talked about how this store is bigger and it has more of the recreational items. What about the two others, the other stores? You've got Heber, you've got one at the Christian Center itself. Is there another one that I've forgotten about?
So we have at the 1283 location, Deer Valley Drive, we have a boutique and we have a thrift store. They're smaller, and then Heber has all the items that I just described that Summit Exchange has as well. So we have everything at Heber, same as Summit Exchange: furniture, clothing, home goods, rec gear, all that kind of stuff. And then in the boutique, it's more clothing, higher end items, and then, you know, jewelry, bags, home decor, some furnishings, not that much. And then the thrift store in Park City also has clothing and home goods, homewares, stuff like that.
Excellent. Now, how is the exchange staffed? And do you accept volunteers to come help out?
We would love volunteers. You can go to our website, click on Get Involved, and then you'll just fill out a volunteer application. Someone will be in touch with you. We are more than happy to accept volunteers. We have, our store is open. That store is open from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. in the summer. So we do have a couple of shifts. We are fully staffed right now, But I'm just going to put it out there. I need some non-seasonal workers coming up next month, starting August. We'll probably open up the application process for that store, in the next week or two.
Okay, so we talked about how many pounds you guys move. Mm-hmm. What kind of money do you raise through these sales?
Well, we have a lot. All of our resources go right back into the community. So we fund two food pantries, one in Wasatch County for the Heber and Wasatch County folks, and then one here in Summit County. We have multiple mobile food pantries where we take food to communities where people might not have the ability to come to our food pantries. We have a basic needs assistance program. We have counseling scholarships. We have multiple other programs that I'm sure you've heard many things about. And one of our biggest is our upcoming Back to School Basics. It's gonna be on Tuesday and Wednesday, August 6th and 7th. And another plug, that's gonna be our grand opening. So we are open, but we're gonna have a grand opening event on August 6th and 7th, same as our Back to School Basics Day. So we hope you'll come out for both of those.
Now the Back to School Basics last year, that was at the outlets. Is that the same building? Is that that you now are in, or is it a different outlet?
It's a different building.
So it takes a lot of space, the Back to School Basics gig, because you've got backpacks, you've got notebooks, you've got all this stuff. What are you going to do? Shove everything to the side and make room for Back to School Basics?
No, so they're going to have their own little storefront.
Okay.
And then the store will be open, and we will have a sale for the kiddos and their families, just the same as all the other stores that participate with the outlets.
Let's talk a little more about Back to School Basics, because it's a fantastic program, and I'm not sure people understand the scope of it. Can you sort of lay out what happens at Back to School Basics?
Well, we have registrations that have been open, and I am not the program director, so I know a lot about it, but I don't know all the details. We take registrations. Families get to sign up each of their kids that are registered in either Summit or Wasatch County, and they will come away with a gift card of $100, a brand new backpack, school supplies, and when they shop at the outlets with that gift card, multiple stores have extended an additional discount to those families. It's a really great resource. It's one of our best programs, and it's really needed in this community.
Having been a volunteer at that function, I can tell you the looks of the kids as they see those backpacks getting excited about school is unbelievable.
It is, and it's really awesome that these kids get to go to the store and just like pick out, you know, whatever they want with this gift card. So it's a really awesome program.
So we talked, staying on money, do you have a sense, and this, I'm not trying to stump the guest here, but obviously a certain amount of money comes in through these programs. Do you have a sense of what percentage of the center's operating budget is actually driven by these kind of retail sales?
I don't know a ton of numbers. I know we fed 53,900 people last year.
That's a number.
I know that we have, all these programs and staff. I don't have the exact percentage, but I would guess that it's up there to at least half of our budget. I'm not exactly sure though.
Now, if a house was open. But empty. You know, let's say that people left for whatever reason. Would you send a truck over to clear out the house and then make the furniture and kitchenware, everything available in one of the, maybe the exchange?
Yeah. If someone is moving and has a big pickup, we can just, if you just reach out to our organization, you can go to ccfpc.org, donate items. There's a link and an email, and you will email the person, send pictures of what you have, and then they will contact you to do a pickup.
Okay, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Just love the recycling and upcycling and giving back to our community, and we hope you will come and shop and find some items. I know you will find some great stuff in all three of our stores, Park City, 1283 Deer Valley Drive, Heber Valley Thrift is at 55 East Center Street, and then Summit Exchange is at the outlets of Park City right beside Nike and Pearl Izumi.
Heather, thank you very much for your time. Everybody, that is the Summit Exchange out at the outlets. We went over the hours, days.
Monday through Saturday, 11 to 8. The other stores are Monday through Saturday, 10 to 5.
Thank you for your time. We'll be right back.
Thanks.
And we are joined in the studio by Matt Hopkins, owner of Cortona out in Kimball Junction. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Can you tell us, why haven't you been open for lunch all these years?
Well, dinner for us is really busy. We've been working our way. We've had this vision for a while now, but pretty much it's been the staffing been one of the biggest things. I have a really great crew right now. Very lucky, because I know everyone out there in the restaurant industry, you know, hopes for the same blessings that I've occurred right, which I have right now. And we were able to go forward. So this will be the third week right now, opening for lunch. So today at 11 o'clock, it has nothing to do with our dinner menu. So we've incorporated more of a sandwich, a sub, if you're East Coast, looking for that wonderful hoagie roll on those lines. We've incorporated Chicago beef, paninis. So we've totally gotten away from our dinner menu just to do something out in the Kimball area an upscale lunch experience for you on your sandwiches and stuff.
Yeah. I love it. At 11 o'clock, I can get over there?
Yes, sir. From here, I'm heading there.
So, sandwiches, do you also have, are there any pizzas or pastas available at the lunch menu?
So the full menu for our main subs will be, you have a chicken parmesan, you have our Nona meatballs, so a meatball parmesan, you have an eggplant parmesan, you have the Chicago beef with the jardinier. I'll serve that with a nice spicy pepper for you, if you're on the net. You have a choice of pasta salad and chips with that. Then we go down to paninis. The paninis, we have a chicken pesto panini. We have an Italian panini, which is all of our fresh sliced cured meats with a olive spread, which we make in-house to really set that off. And then we also have a caprese panini as well. For the vegetarians and the vegans, we're doing a Chicago style with a mushroom-based meat to it, which is unbelievable. And that's with the jardiniere, and you actually get to fulfill your,
your junk food habit while being healthy?
It is.
So I'm intrigued by this. Who makes the mushroom product for you? Is it commercially available, or do you do it yourself?
No. So it's not a product which is made.
You make it.
So it is comes off of a mushroom stem we use, and by just pounding it out and stuff like that, most of your flavor comes from the mushroom cap. So it isn't overwhelming on the mushroom, but it takes on an incredible beef characteristic.
What kind of mushroom is that?
I won't go into that one right now.
Okay. Trade secrets. Okay, so we got...
And then we also have calzones and strombolis we've added to the menu, plus all of our pizzas.
Okay. Calzone, stromboli, what is the difference besides the shape? Is it a different dough?
No, everything's our same dough, but basically your stromboli will have your meats to it.
Okay.
So that'll be our cured sliced meats to it. And then when we go to the calzone, you could add any meats you want to the calzone as well, but the calzone is a cheese. So it has a ricotta, a provolone, or mozzarella. And then we serve the sauce on the side where the stromboli will actually have a little red sauce to it inside.
And so we dip the calzone.
Yes, there we are.
And don't dip the stromboli.
You can get something on the side if you want. It's all on you.
Beautiful.
What are you hungry for?
Everything right now you just described.
Yeah, but we're only doing lunch just Monday through Friday. We're just concentrating on the professional groups out there, which seems to have been taken off pretty well. And then dinner is 7 days a week, you know, from 5 o'clock on. But lunch is from 11 to 3. Then dinner starts up at 5 o'clock.
What's the approximate price point?
Approximate price point. Your sandwiches are 16 on those lines right there. We also have some beautiful salads as well. A great Caesar. We have an arugula salad, and then our typical just house salad as well.
And in an era where you pay $12 for a Subway sandwich, that's quite a reasonable price point.
I like to say my sandwiches, you're probably going to get two meals out of it. Or a nap afterwards.
Okay, let's zoom back a little bit. We didn't really talk about the restaurant as a whole. So where is it, how big is it, and how long have you been there?
So I'm the second ownership of Cortona Italian Cafe. The restaurant has now been there 12 years. We're just down from the State Liquor Store a few doors in Kimball Junction there on Ute Boulevard. We came in and purchased it just over 4 years ago. And back then, it was only a 40, we could seat 40 people. And that's, you know, and it's a big difference now. We've expanded.
Did you take the old ledger space? Is that what you did?
Yeah. Okay. So we are capacity now. We have a full bar now, capacity up to 120 people. We just redid the old side again just this past fall. And the new side, which we expanded into, is now 2 years old now. Yeah.
Excellent. Now at lunch, will you have the short rib pasta, my favorite dish over there?
That's at 5 o'clock.
Okay. Let's sort of talk. Kevin has led us into the segue to a tour of the menu. Let's talk about your, you know, what is it? What are the sort of big elements of your menu, and what's your bestseller?
I gotta say it's our pasta. So, all of our pasta is imported. We ordered it a big flat at a time. It's put away, so I can get my hands on it when I need it. 7 different pastas every day we make, and which is really good because if you have stomach issues and stuff with glutens, all of our flour is imported and doesn't go through those processings. So celiac's a whole different story, but for a person that just want to get away from a certain gluten, they really are able to come in and really enjoy our pasta. Now, that doesn't go for our pizza dough, though. Okay. That's just our pasta.
Okay, so we have 7 different pastas that you serve? Is that what you said?
Yes,
I'm having this vision of this giant refrigerator truck pulling up to the back of the restaurant. You really order it in large, like, how does it come? I'm fascinated.
Oh, no, we make everything in-house. Okay. Everything.
It's the flour that comes, that you import.
Exactly.
Okay, that's what I'm confused.
And then we're also a gelateria. So we have 16 flavors of gelato in-house.
Half which a Baskin we make, Robbins.
Which, yeah. That's 18, right?
I think it's 32.
32,
anyway.
Okay. But that's a another big item for our restaurant. When people walk into the restaurant and they first encounter the gelato bar and, you know, they just start taking their cell phones out and takes pictures, heads it off to their table so they know what they're going to get into for their dessert for that evening.
Perfect.
Okay, so tell us about the different pastas that you, I mean, the different pasta dishes that you serve.
Yeah, for our pastas, for anything going out with any of our meat products, we make a gemelli. Gemelli is a small spiral noodle which coats very well with our piccatas, which, ever, you know, our great local following, you know, they can't get enough of our chicken piccata. Also with the chicken parmesan, our veal dishes, the veal salta bocca, and the veal piccata. From there, we have a bucatini, which is, you know, similar to the look of a spaghetti, but it's a larger pasta with a hole through the middle, which really absorbs the sauce. We have the fresh fettuccine, then all of our pasta, which we make for our lasagna, which is old world lasagna with a bechamel sauce, which we really in one of our best sellers. People call and order that ahead as well.
I've heard that.
Yeah. Right now, it's a halibut season, so we're getting beautiful halibut in for a halibut oreganata, which people have really get clung to here for, like, coming in every week just to have one of those dishes as well.
So you always have at least some fish dishes on the menu?
Yeah. Branzino is the staple there, and then, you know, judging by the season, what comes around, we'll always bring in another one as well.
And I believe you also offer some kind of family style carryout dinners. Is that still on your agenda?
We do. We just had a quite a big groups this weekend. Family lasagnas, comes in a tray. You could have it take out raw or have it cooked in-house. A lot of people prefer to take it out raw because then they can choose what time they're going to have their dinner that evening. It just takes about 35 minutes in the convention, in their regular oven to cover all that.
So you have lasagna. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are the other carryouts?
We do a fettuccine meatball. And then also some of our other dishes, which travel well, I suggest to people as well. Mm-hmm. Short rib bolognese travels very well.
He lights up when you say that.
Yeah, I know.
The chicken parmesan, yeah, travels well. So, yeah, great for carry out.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Now, once again, so it is in Kimball Jungle. It's on the ground floor.
Yes, on the
right
ground
by
floor.
The liquor store. You can't miss a big sign.
We just had some artwork done. For everyone that's been telling me, can we put a little bit extra artwork outside just so we can see it? So Cortona is standing out with some new signage there because a lot of new people that come to our restaurant always go, wow, we thought it was closed.
Yeah.
But, you know, we are open. We always keep it on low key.
Excellent, Matt. Thank you very much. Thank you so much
for having us.
Looking forward to getting over there.
Right. We'll be right back after this.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.